Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little later on this program, for those of you who are political junkies or who just want to keep close tabs on the Missouri General Assembly, a new way to do so. But first, a new look at a popular musical group. It would be a mistake to try and compartmentalize both the Staples singers and the best known of them, Mavis Staples. You can't put their music in a single box. It crosses many genres. They were equally at home in a church, a civil rights rally, or other concert venue. Not only were they hugely successful as performers, their music was to many the soundtrack of the civil rights movement. There's a new book out tracking the career of this family of musicians. It's titled, I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, the Staples Singers, and the March of Freedom's Highway, written by Chicago Tribune music critic Greg Kot. He's also co-host of Sound Opinions, a public radio program about pop music produced at WBEZ in Chicago. We air it on our Gateway HD2 channel on Saturdays at 1 p.m. He joins us from Chicago. Greg, nice to have you with us.
No problem, Don. I'm glad to be here.
Quite a project, and I guess it's a project of love, given so much of the story was centered in Chicago with this particular family.
Yes, absolutely. I think that was one of the prime motivations to do it. We have this, I consider Mavis and the Staples Singers a national treasure, and to me it was kind of amazing that a book has never been written about them, and I thought, you know, it's about time. And, you know, I found out later on that Mavis was somewhat reluctant to have her biography told or entrusted to a writer. But I think she had a sense of, you know, if I'm not going to do it now, when am I going to do it? And it's an amazing story, and I was privileged to be able to get an opportunity to write it and access to the family and their archives.
That's so important, isn't it? I mean, the access you had, I guess, it was unprecedented.
Well, I don't know if unprecedented, but they certainly gave me a lot of access. I mean, once Mavis decided that she wanted to go ahead with the book, she did, say, I'll sit down with you and talk to you as much as you want. And we ended up doing 40, 50, probably close to 60 hours worth of interviews in the last couple of years. That's just with Mavis. And I also spoke to Yvonne, her sister, extensively, and her brother, Purvis. Her father, Pops Roebuck Staples, died in 2000, but I did have an opportunity to talk to him several times in the 90s. Mavis's sister, I'd also met her, Cleotha, but she'd had Alzheimer's the last few years and was unable to grant any interviews. She died last year. But Cleotha did contribute to this book mightily because she was the family archivist, and I was able to gain access to basically everything that they had saved and kept over the last 30, 40, 50 years. That was invaluable. And the last piece of it was that I'd come across a nugget that Mavis gave to an interviewer in the 90s, basically saying that her father was working on a memoir. And, lo and behold, 15 years later, I'm calling Mavis up and I'm saying, what exactly was that about? Do you remember that memoir? And she called me back the next day and said, you know, I think I do remember him working on something like that. I think it was actually written down and never published. And I said, you've got to find that. A week later, she calls me. She'd found the memoir. It was 200 plus pages. And the beauty of it was that it was Pops really writing about his upbringing, the time that he spent on a Mississippi sharecropper's farm from the date of his birth in 1914 through the mid-30s when he came to Chicago. So a big part of the story that I had very little documentation on was filled in, gaining access to that unpublished memoir.
I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but I'm under the impression that you also broke the story that Bob Dylan at one time proposed to Mavis.
Well, she had talked about it before, including with me in an interview we did a number of years ago, but I wanted to get the full story, and I was able to get a lot more detail about the relationship. And, you know, the short version is that Dylan was a huge Staples Singers fanatic when he was growing up in northern Minnesota. Here's this kid listening to the late night stations beaming music from the South, and he was entranced with the R&B music, the blues, and the gospel that he was hearing. And the Staples Singers really stood out. To him, the voices sounded like nothing else. Pops' guitar playing sounded like nothing else. They were unique. He was an astute a student of music, and he understood what made the Staples Singers different than all of the other gospel groups he was hearing. The power of those voices there, you know, they almost sounded ancient compared to some of the other singers who were out there in just the gravity of those voices blending with Pops' guitar, which was unique. He used a lot of reverb, that tremolo guitar, creating this almost spooky atmosphere around those voices. So when he came to New York in the early 60s, he made it a point to go see the Staple Singers perform. They were performing at a festival in New York in 1962 with Mahalia Jackson, and he was blown away by the Staple Singers. He was able to also see and meet Mavis, and pretty much fell pretty hard for her. You know, he actually proposed marriage to Mavis when they were on a television show together in early 1963. The Staple Singers had started to perform Dylan songs. Pop Staples was loved what he was hearing from this kid. He goes, you know, what is this white kid from northern Minnesota got to say about my life? And Purvis, his son, was saying, Dad, no, you got to listen to this song, Blowing in the Wind. You know, how many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man? And Pops really related to what was being said in that song. It was really, to him, symbolic of what was going on in his life and in the emerging civil rights movement. So they started performing that song before anybody else. They were the first group outside of the folk scene to be performing Dylan songs. So Dylan had a relationship with the group, and he also was falling hard for Mavis, which he declared publicly in the early 60s. They were on this television show together, a folk special that was being sponsored by CBS. They were in the big CBS building downtown Manhattan early 63. They were waiting for their lunch on a break in the cafeteria, and the Staple Singers were at the front of the line, and there's a voice from the back of the line, Pops, I want to marry Mavis. And that Dylan comes waddling up to Pops and says, Pops, I want to marry Mavis. And Pops is like, don't tell me, tell Mavis. She's standing right here. You know, Dylan had it a little bit backwards. The romance hadn't begun yet, but he was already proposing marriage to Mavis Staples. But the romance did begin soon after that. And Mavis told me that the relationship really started to flourish at the Newport Folk Festival a few months later, where Dylan was kind of like a little puppy dog following Mavis around, according to Yvonne. And would actually fall asleep at the foot of their bed. You know, Yvonne and Mavis would share a room together at various festivals that they would go to. And Dylan was just hanging around. He wanted to be around Mavis as much as possible. Mavis said that was when we had our first kiss, and they had a relationship that lasted a number of years before Mavis actually got married to a mortician from Chicago. She said the reason that she did not marry Dylan was that she always wondered what Martin Luther King would think if she married across racial lines. And now she says, it's my biggest regret that I didn't accept his marriage proposal then. But they clearly still have a very strong relationship. Dylan has been a huge champion of their music across the decades, and that has never wavered. And I think there's always been a little something between Dylan and Mavis Staples.
Well, you mentioned Martin Luther King, and of course that's a big part of the story that you tell in your book. But I'd like to go back just a little bit farther than that and pick up with the words that you used earlier on when you said that Mavis and the Staple Singers were a national treasure. Why specifically do you put it that way?
Well, I think, first of all, musically, they've contributed an immense amount of memorable music. They were a groundbreaking gospel group. Their song, Uncloudy Day, was one of the biggest gospel hits of all time. It put them on the map and enabled them to tour nationally. Those tracks on VJ that they cut for the VJ label in Chicago in the 50s are, you know, as Dylan noted, unique. They didn't sound like any other gospel group. They had those old style Southern harmonies, the harmony vocals that Pops learned with his family on the sharecropping farm on Dockery Farm in Mississippi. You know, after supper, after a hard day's work, the family, all 14 of the kids, Pops is one of 14 kids, would sing, would stand on the porch or the galley, as they called it, and sing. And other families would come from other farms and join them in these four-part harmonies that they had that they would use in church during their services. So Pops had this sound in his head that he taught his family when he came to Chicago in the mid-30s, gathered them around him in the late 40s and taught them these four-part harmonies that he brought from Mississippi with him. He combined that with his guitar playing, which was learned at the foot of Charlie Patton, the founder of the modern blues. Patton was also lived on Dockery Farm, but he was a performer. He didn't have to share crop. He was making enough money as a blues performer, and this totally entranced Pops. He would watch Charlie Patton's hands at close range and basically taught himself how to play guitar watching one of the most important musicians of the 20th century at close range. He was also a contemporary of Howlin' Wolf. Howlin' Wolf was also on that plantation. So you had these two streams, blues and gospel, running side by side, and it made the sound of the Staple Singers unique. The combination of that blues guitar with the gospel harmonies, it was not a common sound in the 50s. You pretty much would hear piano or organ backing the vocals of the gospel singers. But here Pops is introducing the guitar to the sound. It was very sparse but haunting and kind of had roots, it seemed like, in the 19th century. It reminded people in the North of home, and it really resonated with the Southern population that had moved north and seeking work, much like Pops did in the 30s. Then you move on to the protest era in the 60s, the civil rights era. You know, the way that the Staple Singers were able to morph their message from sort of a more pure gospel message, taking biblical passages and songs rooted in biblical text, and transferring them into more self-empowerment messages. Again, very spiritual, but more self-directed at the African-American community about empowerment and about the idea that every person was worth something. This neatly dovetailed with Martin Luther King's message. And then you have the huge hits in with Stax Records in the 70s, I'll Take You There, Respect Yourself. And then finally the fourth or fifth act in Mavis Staples' career here in the last 10 years, where she's transformed herself into a powerful solo act. The Staple Singers are no longer active. As I mentioned, Pops died in 2000, Cleotha died last year. But Mavis is still singing with her sister Yvonne, but she's kind of remade herself into a solo act, and I can't think of too many performers in the history of popular music that have had as many successful incarnations as Mavis Staples. You talk about an artist who is making music as strong today as she as she heads towards her 75th birthday in July, as she did when she was a teenager in the 50s, and that's a pretty amazing run for any artist.
We're going to listen to her in just a moment, but I have to take a break. Greg Kot, he is the author of I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staple Singers, and The March of Freedom's Highway. He is our guest. He joins us from Chicago. We'll take that break, come back, and listen to a little bit of Mavis Staples and talk more with Greg. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Greg Kot, the author of I'll Take You There, which is the story of Mavis Staples and the Staples Singers. And, Greg, the title, I'll Take You There, I don't suppose it would take too much to figure out how you came up with that title.
Well, it's one of the Staples Singers' most well-known songs, maybe their most well-known song, recorded at for Stax Records in the early 70s, actually recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, with the great rhythm section there. And it is sort of symbolic, I think, of a lot of things. Not only their immense popularity in the 70s, but also inherent in the title is the idea of I'll take you there, I'm going to take you someplace. This idea that their music was a vehicle for change in the African-American community. They really celebrated this idea of what Martin Luther King was talking about, the idea of the civil rights movement. When they met Martin Luther King in the early 60s, Pops and Martin Luther King were very close friends. They were essentially Pops's Martin Luther King Jr.'s opening act when Martin Luther King would present his speeches to congregations, especially in Chicago. They were kind of Martin Luther King's point band. You know, every night he would ask Pops, "Hey, you gonna perform my song tonight, Pops?" You know, he had favorite songs. He loved the group. Pops loved him. I'll Take You There, I think, was an extension of that legacy into the framework of popular music. You know, taking it out of the ministry and the church and the civil rights rallies and getting it on the radio. It was a huge, huge hit.
Let's give our audience a chance to hear some of that. We won't play it all in the interest of time, but this is Mavis Staples, and I'll Take You There. Mavis Staples, I'll Take You There. And Greg Cott, I have to tell you that our production staff has got the beat. Everybody's moving on the other side of the glass. What emotion. What emotion in that voice. I mean, she just had the ability, has the ability to really take you there, if I may say so.
Yeah, the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, the guys who performed on that song had worked with just about everybody important in that era. They'd worked with the Rolling Stones. They worked with Paul Simon. They were on hits with Wilson Pickett, Percy Sledge. They'd worked on all these great records. They'd worked with Aretha Franklin. I interviewed the guys in the rhythm section at Muscle Shoals about that session, and to a man, they say that that was the greatest single session of their lives, working with Mavis Staples in the studio that day, crafting I'll Take You There. Basically, the song was, you know, they said it was just a sketch when we started working with it. It was five lines of verse written by Al Bell, who was the producer on the session. He was also the head of Stax Records. He was a huge advocate of the Staple Singers. But he had the basic idea for the song in those five lines, and he had an idea for a bass line, which was based on Jamaican reggae. And basically, the band and Mavis together in the studio fleshed out the rest of the song. It's essentially an improvisation. And the guys were saying what Mavis did in the studio that day was absolutely amazing. And it was her gospel, her background in gospel that enabled her to do it. What they call the Holy Ghost moment. You know, the Spirit walks in the room and the singer is transformed. And in the process, she transforms everybody around her. So she's calling out the part. She's, you know, come on, help me. You know, the vocals come in. She's talking to the bass player, give me a little bass, and she's playing the bass part for him, singing it alongside him. Then she's calling out the keyboard player, and then the guitar player. You know, she would say, hey, daddy, referring to her father, Pop Staples, who was the guitar player in the Staple Singers. But a little known fact, Pops doesn't actually play the guitar on that session because they had one of the Muscle Shoals guys playing guitar on that particular song, Eddie Hinton. But Hinton was playing in Pops' style. And when Pops would perform the song live, you know, the Hey Daddy part fit in fantastically well with what was going on. So Mavis was really, you know, she orchestrated that whole song on the fly. And I think one of the deepest regrets that Mavis has about her musical career is that she did not receive full credit for her role in that song. Al Bell has sole songwriting credit on that song. It's been a matter of some contention between Bell and Mavis Staples, and is one of the reasons that the group eventually left Stax Records a few years later to move on from there. But that particular session, it's one of the greatest pieces of music of that era. You know, I interviewed Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones for the book, and he still says it was the greatest R&B song of its time. The Stones reached out to the Staple Singers to tour with them soon after the Stones had come out with Exile in Main Street. They wanted the Staple Singers to be on the bill with them as they toured North America, and Pops turned them down. Well, we can make more money on our own.
there was a problem with the Rolling Stones at some point, though. Wasn't there a lifting of some lyrics or some music of some sort?
Oh, yeah. The Stones were huge fans to the point where, like a lot of rock groups in the 70s, 60s and 70s, would appropriate, quote-unquote, lyrics and riffs from their favorite R&B and gospel songs, and the Stones were no different. You know, last time, this could be the last time, probably a lot of people are familiar with that Rolling Stones hit from the mid-60s, Keith Richards flat out said, I was listening to the Staple Singers version of that song. It was an old gospel song that Pops transformed, particularly with his guitar riff. And Keith was paying attention to Pops' guitar riff. And he said, I lifted Pops' guitar riff for our own version of the song. Now, the Stones secularized the lyrics. They changed the lyrics considerably. But Pops knew what was going on. And he did say... at one point years later that, you know, he felt he should have gotten a songwriting credit on that particular song because of what the Stones did. But I think at the same time, he understood that the Stones were in some ways reflecting some light back on the Staple Singers and helping them reach a wider audience as a result of that. There was a lot of rockers who loved what the Staple Singers were doing in the late 60s, and that helped the Staple Singers cross over to that audience when they made the move there.
Given the death announced this morning of Pete Seeger, I'm wondering, did their paths ever cross?
You know, I don't have a lot of evidence of Pete Seeger and the Staples interacting a lot. The Staple Singers did interact quite a bit with a lot of people in the folk movement. I wouldn't be surprised if Seeger crossed paths with them because they did have a lot of interaction. The Staples did with people like the Freedom Singers. They had interaction with Dylan, as I mentioned earlier. Joan Baez was a huge fan. Judy Collins. Bonnie Raitt was a huge fan. They were a big part of that folk scene. The folk scene definitely embraced what the Staple Singers were doing. But I don't have a lot of information about Pete Seeger interacting with them. But I'm sure they were aware of each other. And in a lot of ways, what they were singing about and some of the messages they were delivering in their songs certainly had a common purpose.
Well, we have a caller here who wants to link the Pete Seeger reference. Let's bring in Dennis calling from Overland. Dennis, go ahead, please.
I'm like the author. I'm not sure whether I don't have a memory of Pete Seeger being with them, but certainly, and I think about Chicago with Studs Terkel and Mahalia Jackson and all of the things, the courage that all these people had, and of course the Staple Singers came up behind. I'm just remembering that Sam Cooke supposedly wrote "Change Gonna Come." Because of, if I remember right, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, and some of the stuff that Dylan had done, and he was kind of like, what, you know, we haven't done anything for, we need a song, and so he sat down and he said the song kind of wrote itself, and I'm enjoying this, and I love the Staple Singers, and of course Mavis is just wonderful, and I'm looking forward to the book.
Dennis, thanks for the call. He referenced Sam Cooke, and of course, Sam Cooke is mentioned often in your own book, Greg.
Yeah, thank you for the call. I appreciate the nice comments. Yes, Sam Cooke was a childhood friend of the Staple Singers. They grew up in the same neighborhood. Sam Cooke, Lou Rawls, Mahalia Jackson was a frequent visitor to the Staple Singers' home. So yes, they knew each other very well. Sam Cooke and Purvis Staples, Mavis's brother, would often sing together or as part of a battle of the bands, as they called it, at the church across the street from the grade school they all attended, Doolittle, on the south side of Chicago. And the girls would all come and watch, 12 and 13-year-old girls watching these 14, 15-year-old guys singing gospel songs, and sometimes the gospel songs would turn into doo-wop and R&B songs when the parents weren't watching, and they were swooning over Sam Cooke back then. Cooke started out his career as a gospel singer with the Soul Stirrers. He was very well known to everybody in Chicago, close friends with the Staples. He made the transition to pop music. In fact, Sam Cooke's last concert as a gospel singer was on a bill with Mavis Staples and the Staple Singers in the late 50s, around 1957. And Mavis remembers Sam Cooke getting booed off the stage for trying to perform a secular song in front of this gospel audience. They called Sam Cooke a backslider. You know, you can't sing pop and gospel. You have to do one or the other. And everybody took note of that. But as the caller said, Sam Cooke, after being in the pop realm for a number of years, basically singing love songs and party songs, was energized and moved, very moved by what he was hearing from the folk movement in the early 60s and as part of the civil rights struggle. You know, the references I have, Dylan was not only a huge influence on the Staples, but also Cooke in writing A Change Is Gonna Come. And it was one of the last songs he was credited with writing and releasing in the hours around his death, when he died so tragically in the early 60s. That song was a hit posthumously, but it was one of those soundtracks for the civil rights movement. It's interesting how so much of the civil rights great anthems were based in Chicago and coming from that neighborhood. Curtis Mayfield, another close family friend, whom they met at VJ Records in the 50s when he was just a teenager alongside Jerry Butler in the Impressions, was also an architect for a lot of the civil rights songs that were performed. The Staples Singers, Sam Cooke, a lot of this stuff was coming out of Chicago. And Chicago, of course, ended up being Martin Luther King's northern base for the civil rights movement. When he brought his movements from the South to the North, Chicago was the first city he came to. Not because it was so welcoming. In fact, just the opposite. He ran into a lot of opposition when he came to Chicago. He called it a more segregated city than anything he'd ever seen in the South, and he was right. But at the same time, he thought it was very important because of the huge African-American population in Chicago to form a base here. And that sort of established Jesse Jackson the career of Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson was one of his prime lieutenants. He set up Jesse Jackson in Chicago and had the Staples Singers essentially help Jackson establish his base in Chicago. So there was a lot of intimacy between the music, the movement, the folk movement, and the words of Martin Luther King throughout this era.
A lot of connecting dots. You know, you mentioned Mahalia Jackson, and I have a note in front of me here about an album she did, that is Mavis did, in 1996, dedicated to Mahalia Jackson. Obviously, she felt very, very strongly about Mahalia.
Well, Mahalia was the queen of gospel music. She was the most the foremost gospel performer at the time, and for Mavis, a huge formative influence to hear a female voice, because her dad, coming from a tradition of gospel singing and gospel quartet singing, was playing a lot of records by male gospel groups for that reason. He had grown up in that sort of tradition where he was in a male gospel group and play a lot of records by male gospel singers. But when Mavis, as a young girl, heard her daddy playing Mahalia Jackson, it was striking to her, first of all, to hear a female voice, and then also to hear how powerful and moving and brilliant it was. It was a huge influence on her. She fantasized about meeting Mahalia Jackson, and you know, it turned out Mahalia only lived a few blocks away from where the Staples Singers were based, and they became friends. As a very young girl, 8-9 years old, Mavis was able to meet her idol, and Mahalia took her under her wing. Mahalia could be tough on singers that she perceived as rivals in the gospel community. But with Mavis, I think it was more of a motherly kind of instinct that she had toward her. She didn't see her as a rival or a threat necessarily. And so she embraced Mavis. And that relationship lasted their entire lifetime. In fact, there's a memorable concert that they performed together in the late 60s in Harlem. When Mahalia, her health was starting to fail, and there was literally a passing of the microphone on that stage that day where Mahalia started to perform and asked Mavis to come on stage and help her finish a song that they were doing together. And you can see that moment on film. It's a really powerful, moving moment where Mavis is coming on stage to help her mentor finish the song, and they end up finishing the song together. 2 years later, Mahalia would die. But it was a grand gesture by Mahalia to sort of recognize that Mavis had been part of her life for so long, and that she wanted her to be a part of it near the end of her life as well.
You know, let's take a listen to that tribute that Mavis paid to Mahalia Jackson, the 1996 album that I mentioned, and I think most people will be familiar with this particular number.
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. The whole world in his hands. He's got you and me, brother, in his hands. You and me, sister, in his hands. He's got you and me, brother, in his hands. The whole world in his hands. If religion was a thing that money could buy, whole world in his hands. The rich would live and the poor would die. The whole world in his hands. He's got the whole world.
Mavis Staples and her tribute to the late Mahalia Jackson. Boy, she really goes back to her roots very, very easily, doesn't she, Greg Cutt?
Yeah, she's, you know, that style of singing, it's been with her. I mean, she was performing publicly at the age of 8 years old in Chicago. She was this little tiny thing. She's barely 5 feet tall now, but even then she was small, very tiny kid. She had to stand on a chair to reach the microphone, but she still always had that deep bass voice. When Pops started the family band with his kin, Mavis got the low parts, even though she was the youngest and smallest. She always had that big voice, and you know, the Mahalia mentorship meant so much to her. Mahalia was such a close friend of the family, and here it's almost hard to imagine a person of Mahalia's stature, you know, showing up on the 4th of July in the Mavis in the Staples family's backyard in sandals and a sundress. She'd call up a Mom Staples at, you know, 5 or 6 in the morning and say, "Mom, you got them bones on?" You know, because she wanted those ribs that Mom Staples would make every 4th of July. And it was always a feast. And people, you know, these celebrities, you know, people we regard as celebrities and legendary entertainers, people from the world of baseball, you know, Jim Mudcat Grant, Jesse Jackson, Jesse Owens, Mahalia Jackson, Albertina Walker. These were the kind of people that were daily parts of the Staples family's lives, and they would all show up at this big barbecue. Oh, to be, you know, like a fly on the wall, huh?
You took the
when that was going down.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was just about to say exactly the same thing, Greg Cutt. I have to take another break. Let's do that now. We'll come back and talk more about one of the personalities that wasn't so high, I guess, in the most favored list. That would be Aretha Franklin. We'll pick that up when we come back. Greg Cutt is our guest. He is the author of Mavis Staples. I'll take you there. Mavis Staples, the Staples Singers, and the March Up Freedom's Highway. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Greg Cutt, the author of I'll Take You There. That's the story of Mavis Staples and the Staples Singers. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom following today. Attorneys for Missouri death row inmate Herbert Smalls continue last-minute efforts to spare his life. Smalls is scheduled to die by injection in about 12 hours for killing a St. Louis County jeweler in 1991. A Missouri House panel will vote this evening on its version of an income tax cut plan that could affect both business and individuals. The Missouri Court of Appeals has agreed with a lower court judge that Moline Acres' speed camera conflicts with state law. The opinion is similar to a ruling in the Ellisville red light camera case, which says local traffic enforcement cameras permit something that state law prohibits and are therefore illegal. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Greg Cutt. But before we do that, let me just remind everyone or tell everyone that Greg is going to be appearing Monday, February 3rd at the St. Louis County Library. Maryville University and Left Bank Books are also sponsoring this presentation. That's Monday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. at the St. Louis County Library headquarters at 1640 South Lindbergh. I'm sure you'll have a lot of people there, Greg. Mavis Staples and her family, very, very popular here in St. Louis.
Yeah, it's a great story, Don. And yes, I appreciate the plug. I'm very much looking forward to the event on Monday at the library.
February 3rd. Now, to Aretha Franklin, what was going on there?
Well, interesting relationship, Don. Aretha and Mavis are roughly the same age. They grew up together on the gospel circuit in the late 50s. Mavis from Chicago, obviously, and Aretha from Detroit. They would cross paths frequently because Aretha's father was C.L. Franklin and a man of great stature in the gospel community. He would go and speak at churches throughout the South and draw a huge crowd. Aretha was essentially her father's opening act. She was a young thing back then, playing, sitting down at the piano, and she'd play a couple of songs, a couple of gospel songs before C.L. Franklin, the main attraction, would give his homily for that particular day. But Mavis and her family would cross paths on the Southern Gospel circuit with Aretha, and they did become friends. Aretha was a frequent visitor at the Staples family house. In fact, she would come to Chicago quite a bit just to get away from the pressure she was feeling from her father, who was very much hands-on about her career. He helped orchestrate not only the start of her career as a gospel singer, but he also, with his blessing, moved her over to Columbia Records. She was signed by John Hammond there in the early 60s and made the transition to pop music, much like their friend Sam Cooke had done a few years earlier. So he was very much pulling the strings on Aretha's career, and she was, there were moments where she just didn't want to have any part of it. So she would go hide out at the Staples Singers household. Now, I'd mentioned earlier about how Mahalia Jackson could be tough on her rivals, and I think Aretha Franklin was the same way. I think there was a lot of insecurities that Aretha had despite her prodigious and obvious talent. She was one of the most gifted singers of her generation. She obviously had some huge hits later on in the 60s with Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records. But she was insecure about her voice, and I think she did perceive Mavis as a rival, if only a friendly rival. I mean, their closeness was obvious. There were, there's an album cover of Aretha from the mid '60s where Mavis is essentially the uncredited hairstylist. She was the one who came up with Aretha's hairstyle on that particular record. They would do vacations together. They would stop at each other's homes, but at the same time they would fight. I document a moment when Aretha was upset with Mavis because she perceived that she was making glances at Aretha's husband, Ted White at the time, and they came to blows in Aretha's kitchen, and Mavis left. And at the same time, they maintained a relationship throughout the decades. When Aretha went back to Detroit to make a gospel album in the late 80s, around 1987, she asked Mavis to be a part of it. So the relationship did have its rocky moments. It did have its great moments. But even after that album was done, Mavis noted that she had been mixed down in the record when the final product came out. And Aretha said, hey, it's my record. I can do what I want. So there was always this kind of, they would take shots at each other, which is kind of sad, but it's also speaks to the fact that they were tremendously gifted singers. And, there was a little, frankly, there was a little jealousy there from Aretha, in terms of, Mavis's perceived talent. It's a complex relationship, to say the least. Both are extremely, are two of the greatest singers of our generation, but they didn't always get along.
Talk about wanting to be a fly on the wall. How about being there when they came to blows?
Yeah, it's one of those things where you take you take everybody's documentation of what happened there and talk to everybody that was in the room, and everybody has a slightly different version of what exactly went down. But there is no doubt that Aretha and Mavis got into a physical altercation in Aretha's kitchen.
Yeah, your book is only recently out, Greg Kot, and the critics that I've read have been very positive about it. But I have seen one concern, at least on the part of one critic, who said that this, and I would tend to agree, that this book cries for having an accompanying disc.
Yeah, I agree. Not only a disc, but maybe like four or five of them. I can't disagree at all with that. I mean, it's something that you know, people should hear this music. Hopefully the music, the book will inspire them to go back and go beyond some of the obvious stuff that they've heard from the Staples Singers. It's interesting. People have no bits and pieces of their legacy. They know I'll Take You There or Respect Yourself. Or maybe they've seen The Last Waltz with the band where the Staples Singers just run away with the movie with The Weight, the version, their version of the band song, The Weight. But the band's harmonies, by the way, were influenced by the Staples Singers. But, you know, you go back to the early VJ stuff. I don't think there's a bad track on any of their VJ records from the 50s. That's the stuff I would start with. And I hope people will go back and seek some of that stuff out because it is available. And it's astonishing when you hear it.
We only have about 30 seconds left, Greg Kot. Is she still going as strong today as she was? I mean, obviously she's 75, but does she still have that flame, that emotion, that intensity?
Well, that's the one thing about Mavis. She never phones it in. I've seen Mavis dozens of times now, and I can tell there's certain performers, you know, they're not always there with you that night. It's an off night, or they're not quite there. Mavis is there all the time. She's present in the room and feeling it. She, even if she's not feeling great when she goes on stage, something happens when she gets on that stage, and people feel that, sincerity and that love and the fact that she's in the moment whenever she's on stage. She told me that she has to feel every lyric and personalize it, otherwise she can't sing it. And she communicates that as well as any performer I've ever seen.
Well, you know, there's so much more in the book that we didn't have time to talk about today, so I recommend it one day. Greg Kot, I'll Take You There, Mavis Staples, The Staples Singers, and The March Up Freedom's Highway. A reminder that Greg will be at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on South Lindbergh Monday, February 3rd at 7 o'clock. Greg, thanks so much for being with us. It's been a fascinating subject and obviously one very, very dear and close to your heart. Thanks for being with us.
Don, my pleasure, and thanks a lot for the in-depth interview.